Yes. There's a book of his letters, which is very interesting. So, I think there were a lot of missionaries around here then, though, weren't there?
Oh, yes.
Your days?
Yeah. We had one missionary come to Browning. His name was Father Sewer.
Sewer.
And he was a Belgian. And he went from house to house a horseback to say Mass.
He did.
And he just rode, he carried his lunch, because most places fed him, but he always carried lunch. And he was a living saint.
Yes.
Oh, he went through such hardships, all kinds of weather never stopped him at all. He just kept going. And he lived to be an old priest. I don't know just how old. But I remember he died over on the coast, and he wanted to be buried over here at St. Ignatius.
Oh.
And then he'd been a missionary at Browning, so they shipped his body to Browning. We had services there, and then they shipped him over. His relatives showed up some way or another, and they had to bury him someplace else. They didn't bury him here.
Oh, they should bury him where he wanted to be buried.
They should have, yes.
Yes, indeed. Yes.
But he was so devout, and whenever he was around him, you couldn't help but be just as devout as he was.
Yeah, right.
Had a lot of influence on the Indians.
Well, the Blackfoot Indians have always been considered a very noble group of people.
Yes.
Yes, they have. And so have the Crow. Was there much intermarriage between the tribes?
Not at that time.
No.
But there is now.
There is now. Mm-hmm. Do you remember any, of course you were with the sisters so much, you don't remember any favorite foods?
Among the Indians?
Yes.
Well, they never raised anything, you know. They lived on wild meats and wild berries, fruit, stuff like that, and roots.
Mm-hmm.
They used a lot of roots for medicine, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then lots for food. I know the doctor was talking about health one day. I was cooked at the hospital in Browning, and he was in there talking to us. And I said, well, the Indians used to be so healthy years ago.
Mm-hmm.
There was no sickness among them. And I said, and now they civilized, and there's a lot of sickness among them. And he said, well, when they were young, they lived in the open air and got all the free air and fresh water they wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And they lived on wild fruits and berries and roots, herbs. And then they killed their own meat, that is their buffalo or antelope. And they ate all the insides. They were sure to get plenty of vitamins, he said. And of course now they don't live that way, and they're not as healthy as they were.
I think that's true.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
There's a lot of diabetes among the Indians.
Is there?
Yes.
Is that right?
Yeah. There never used to be.
No.
My sister died of diabetes, and my brother, he had diabetes, but he didn't die from diabetes. He had sclerosis.
Oh.
Where the nerves die, you know.
Yes.
And the nerves died in his hands and arms. He couldn't dress himself. He couldn't feed himself. And it began to, his eyesight was affected, and his hearing was affected, and his legs had begun to be helpless when he died. Because he'd had to been in a wheelchair.
Were there many rattlesnakes around there?
Not around Browning. There's none there now.
No?
No. There's a lot of here around St. Ignatius, not being from here. I don't think there's any right here.
No.
It's a little bit too cold here.
Mm-hmm.
Near this water here too. Mm-hmm. My stepmother was out picking berries one day, and she was bit by a rattlesnake on the calf of her leg. And there was a man that was in the crowd. There was a bunch of them went picking berries, and they were picking what they call bullberries.
Yes.
Or buffalo berries.
Buffalo berries, yes.
And when she got bit by the snake, well, he took his pocket knife out and he just stuck it in there and just cut a gash out of each bite before it had a chance to spread.
Spread into her blood.
And they filled it full of...
I'm trying to show up. I'll tell you what I probably did. Yes, probably all he had, huh?
Yeah, that was all he had.
Yeah.
And so well, she went on picking berries, and when the evening comes, she went home and went to the doctor, and he fixed her up. But she has two scars on her leg now, about a half inch deep.
Yeah. Well, that probably saved her life.
Yes, it did.
Mm-hmm. Yes, those rattlesnakes have always... Rattlesnakes and mosquitoes.
Yes.
Have been the bane of people. You know, you want to go out in the woods, and then you have to be afraid of the rattlesnakes. And if you don't protect yourself, you'll be eaten up by the mosquitoes.
That's right. Mm-hmm. When I cooked in these camps for surveyors, my youngster were just a little tall. Mm-hmm. Especially when he's up in the mountains where there's any bear. Mm-hmm. I had a leather belt about so high, and I buckled around her, and then I had a rope fastened in, and then I tied that rope to the tent pole.
Yes.
She could get around a little bit, but she never was out of my sight.
No.
And we camped one place. It was a bright moonlight night, and I heard a noise, and I thought it was the bear. It was the bear country. So I got up and went to look out, and here were two porcupines. They grunt just like a bear.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and they were eating the bark off the wood pile that they had out there. And I remember, and my youngster, she was just a little thing, she couldn't talk very good, and she says, when I got back to bed, she was awake, she's sitting up and she had real curly hair, and she says, she always called me Mother.
Yes.
Mother, what is it? Is it a bear or turpentine? She says. She was a cute little thing. Little.
Yeah. Is she still living?
Oh, yeah, she's living. She's living in Cutbank.
Oh.
I've been expecting her all week. She's going to Missoula. She has a boy that works in the post office in Missoula.
Uh-huh.
He's worked there for about 20 years.
Oh, my.
She's going to go over and see him.
Yes.
Well, this was in 1884, George Chichester, Ivy's son, Arthur Chichester, who lived in Great Falls most of my life, and George Chichester, and he was the brother of his sister's husband, whatever that relationship would be, came along with them from Red Oak, Iowa. Father had been in the bank down there. He was quite a writer, penman that is. And they wanted him to stay, but he had to go. He had the urge to go out west, and so they had an immigrant train.
Now, would you hold on? I want to make sure that I'm getting this. All right.
They wanted this immigrant train with Well, they had a wagon and perhaps two wagons.
On the train?
In the train, in a train, in a good car, in the immigrant train. It came up through Nebraska and ended in southern Utah, I mean to say Idaho, and a spot called McCammon Junction. And from there on a short line, a narrow gauge line, they ran up to Deer Lodge where the train ended. And they unloaded there and went overland with everything under the sun. They expected to fight Indians, so they had plenty of powder and shot. And finally, they got to Helena, crossed over what is later became known as the Black Grade, and down to Cascade, which is just a little ways above Great Falls, crossed the Missouri River there in June of 1884. And then down to crossing a little stream known as Sand Coulee Creek, which at that time was running bankfall, and they had to wait for a couple of days to get across a stream that ordinarily was about 10 feet wide. It was at this point that Father and his partner decided to take up some land. So he took up 160 acres, which is now included in the land owned by the Mitchells. And it is a dairy farm, some 3 miles south of Great Falls. He arrived there, as I say, in June of 1884, and immediately started a little settlement, little cabin site, put up a little cabin at the mouth of the creek, which is on the bend of the Missouri there. And Great Falls was practically non-existent. They did have a tent there, 8x10, a couple of flop cots in it, and a little sign across the front of it saying, "Hotel, 25 cents. Nothing of any consequence had been built there, but it came on fast, and shortly the town was being formed by an emissary of James K. Hill, who sent out the Paris Gibson there to take up land in that area. And it might be well to mention the fact that there were various kinds of claims that you could get there and hardly anybody there. So also they had to use various ruses, you might say, to get to land quickly and cheaply. So a tree claim was one that could be obtained, 160 acres, by really planting a few trees and having somebody swear they saw trees growing on the place. Another would say that he had a desert claim, and he would have to put water on that claim, and in so doing he'd have somebody plow a furrow, and another, or he himself, would have a wagon that couple of barrels of water in that he would pour into these furrows, and that would be a ditch which indicate that he was irrigating the land. And another 160 went down the drain. And then a third method was to have 160s. It's proposed they were attempting to claim a section. They would build a little cabin at the, where the, or two cabins rather, right, the captains would be set right in the center of the section, mainly for the so that the people who took up the land there would have company and be able to talk to one another for a period of 6 months. And then the captains would be shifted around in the same area, and another 6 months later they would have accomplished their problem, which was to have a section of land there which could be paid for at $1 an acre, and that way the town site of Great Falls was established. And it only took a year or two to have this complete. The father used to say that out at the ranch, when he first went in there, the country was covered with the antelope, who would come down and disturb the haycocks that he put up for his horses, and that the spoor that the animals cast on the hay would have a disturbing effect on the animals, so they wouldn't eat it. So he had to go out and
the horses wouldn't eat it.
The horses wouldn't eat it, and so he had to get rid of a few of them, but they're hardly more than just enough for their own use, which is a very fine adjunct to their daily meal. Now, this was in, I say, in 1884, and about 1886, a spring came, the horses went out on the hills, grazing and eating the first green thing that came up in spring, and got a hold of what later was known as loco weed, a member of the pea family, and it wasn't any time at all that he lost all his horses. It was very poisonous. It was found out later that cattle would eat it too, and it took quite a while to find out it was truly the cause of loco animals was due to the to this weed.
How is that loco spelled?
L-O-C-O. The that fall, Dad's partner had enough, so he went back to Illinois. Dad would have gone the same way, he said, but he didn't have any money, so he got himself a contract to cut some wood for a supply, a logging operation down at the mouth of Sun River, which comes in there just about the where the Great Falls now stands. And his plan, the man, Ira Myers, was running a sawmill there and needed wood to run the engines. And so he gave the father a contract to cut cottonwood logs on 2nd Avenue, or 2nd Island, I should say, up the river above the mouth of Sun River.
What river?
Of Sun River.
Sun. S-U-N?
S-U-N. And so he had to have a grub stake, and he went down to Fort Benton, which was the head of navigation then. And
head of navigation on the Missouri?
On the Missouri, yes. And he met up with a little man that later became one of his best friends, a Jewish gentleman by the name of A. Nathan, who had never seen him before. And it sort of took a liking to him, and he said he told him he needed a grub stake, and so Nathan staked him with beans and bacon and flour and so on for the winter while he went back and fulfilled his contract.
How's that man spell his name?
N-A-T-H-A-N.
What's his first name?
They called him A.
A.
A. Nathan.
A. Nathan. N-A-T-H-A-N.
house, and we went into the clothing business, and was very successful there in the clothing business. Had two sons there that lived there all their lives after he passed on. Well, Dad piled up his wood, floated it down the river when the ice went out, and so after surviving the heaviest winter they'd ever had around there, he managed to get enough money together to get back in business, which is to say he bought some more horses, and he still had the wagons, and so he went into a freighter, freighted between Fort Benton and Helena, and later between Helena and Great Falls, until the railroad moved in there in about 1888 or 9, someplace like that, and he happened that he was out of business then. But his life from then on was in the stock business on this ranch that is now occupied by the Mitchell Dairy, and he had to assist further in building Great Falls because Gibson was developing the area and letting contracts to all sorts of endeavors, industries. In other words, one of them was a streetcar line that ran from downtown out to what we call the Sandhills. Dad had the contract to build that and got a hold of $1,000, which was a lot of money in those days, and which was the background of the stake that he thought was necessary to build a home and get married. And that's what he did at that time, and that was in about 1900.
Did this Gibson, was he instrumental in seeing that the Great Northern Railroad was built out this way?
Gibson, well, I suppose he was. No, I wouldn't say that exactly either, because the whole operation was being conducted by James J. Hill and heading out this way because of the tremendous water power we had there. The Great Falls and the Rainbow Falls and the Black Eagle Falls, all of which are heavy producers of electricity there now.
Well, Paris Gibson actually was, they call him the father of Great Falls.
He was the mayor, and he was a senator for Montana for a while.
Montana is really a great state.
Well, we think it's the state that ought to have more people that you're speaking of now. But because of the tremendous land spread we have, 320 by 540, and only 640, some odd population.
Now, when you give those numbers, is that width by length?
Yes.
First number, and 650?
It's 540 miles long and 320 miles wide.
And what's the population?
About 20,000. About 640.
It's about 600,000.
Yes. There are more people in Phoenix than there are in the whole state of Montana. We have to have more. We have to have an opportunity to spread these densely populated areas somewhere, I think. And I don't see where it would be a better place than in the state of Montana.
What do you think of Mike Mansfield?
I think Mike Mansfield is probably the best senator we've had in Montana. And over it, because during my lifetime, should I say, yes. I'd say that.
Montana has always had very representative people in our Senate, and I think the governors of Montana have always been outstanding persons, haven't they?
I'm trying to think of, we have to give Senator Wheeler a lot of credit for doing Montana a lot of good. And Montana, as you probably know, has always been known as a Democratic state. And within that way, when Father first came to, when they had their first election, in a little schoolhouse near where we lived, in those days, in that precinct, he tells me that they would drive a lumber wagon up to the schoolhouse door, and in it would be a keg of whiskey, and plenty of beer and cigars, and nobody made any bones of coming out and passing the cigars, and you could help yourself to all the refreshments you wanted to.
Who furnished those?
You want me to tell the truth?
The Democratic Party.
You said that, I didn't.
You know, coming back to your first story, you said that they brought to your father, and with the freight train, brought ammunition because expected to fight the Indians. How did those fights turn out?
Well, there weren't any.
There weren't any?
No, the Indians turned out to be his best friends. Mm-hmm. When he needed horses, they had them.
Mm-hmm.
And they never bothered him.
No.
As a matter of fact, the Indian insurrections of those days were pretty well over by that time.
Mm-hmm. There were Indians. They were fighting for their fatherland. Everybody else gets credit for it, and they didn't.
That's true. There was an Indian reservation up above called Fort Shaw, just a little ways up.
Fort
Shaw.
Shaw.
S-H-A-W? It's just up some river about 25 miles west of Great Falls. And that thing, I will remember the man who ran that, his name was F.C. Campbell.
C-A-M-P-B-E-L-L.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, every well-known man, everybody liked him. They had a very fine school up there. And I think that F.C. Campbell moved over to Browning after that. Mm-hmm. Isn't that right?
That's right. He was superintendent there.
Yeah.
A good many years.
Yes, he was a great friend of my father's, too. They had a troop of, when I was just a lad and first went up there, they had a troop of Negro soldiers here.
They did?
Mm-hmm.
How did they get up there?
Well, it was an outpost, you see. It was a fort.
Hmm.
And immediately became this Indian school.
Hmm.
They always had a fine football team.
There it is.
Fine athletes, they all were.
Did any Indians from Montana go to Carlisle? You meet them all on all reservations, the older people that died now, but they were all wonderful persons. Those that gone to Carlisle, they became, if they didn't become leaders in actuality, they were leaders in thought among the people. But they tell some pretty sad stories how, you know, that girls and boys were taken from their families and sent to Carlisle, unknown to the parents, which of course I think is height of cruelty.
Carlisle was a great school for athletics.
Mm-hmm.
Athletics in those days. I think of Jim Thorpe, the famous decathlon athlete, football player. I don't think that any of his caliber ever went to Carlisle from Fort Shaw. I don't think so.
You know, when you speak of Montana, I've always thought of tall men and lack of cattle. Is that about correct? When we meet a great big man out there, I said, well, he must be from Montana.
Mm-hmm.
And then the young fellows would come in and they're all bull-legged. And they said, well, that's because of riding horseback. I don't know.
But the cattle punchers always said bull-legged.
Yes, they had ride the horses.
Yeah. Well, they started off as children riding their early before their bones were actually formed, and I what made them naturally became bull-legged.
Yes.
Well, they didn't start with, they didn't have any saddles, you know.
No.
In the right Indian fashion, right, of course, they didn't have any saddles, so they had to clamp onto their horse with their legs.
Oh, yes.
The heels under the horse's flank. And when they did that at an early age, they naturally bowed the leg.
Yes. Well, this has been very interesting, very worthwhile.
The fairy tales and Fillmore Cooper and
yes.
All those Western tales, I just fed up on them.
The old classics.
Well, that's till I got into high school.
Oh.